coming up on Philosophy Talk.
You are being watched. The government has a secret system, a machine that spies on you every hour of every day. I know because I built it.
Get ready. The day is coming.
First it was your phone and watch. Next will come your car. Then your television, your refrigerator, your whole house.
All wired to the internet, monitoring your every move.
So they are spying on us.
This is all classified.
What did you do? Did you put in a backdoor and route it through GCHQ? I mean, you do CCTV, you do traffic cams. Why don't you have your nose?
Look, what will privacy even mean when every device we own and operate is collecting reams of data on us to share via the internet with corporations and the government?
The Internet of Things. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
What will life be like when every road you travel, every device you own, every building you enter is connected to the internet?
Will it transform our world and allow us to lead richer lives?
Or just give governments and hackers and corporations more chances to spy on us?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We are here at the studios of KLW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative. And this week, our conversation is about the Internet of Things.
So, Ken, what's the big deal about this Internet of Things? I mean, it's just a bunch of appliances and devices and other stuff hooked up to the internet, right? I mean, the internet's been around for decades.
Well, true, but we're talking about a sea change in the digital landscape, Josh. I mean, to start with the vast number and variety of things that are going to be involved in the Internet of Things. It goes way beyond the usual subjects of, you know, phones, computers, and watches. We're talking cars, refrigerators, actually every system or appliance in every building around the world. And it's not just buildings, it's surfaces, roads, bridges, train tracks, and then monitors like heart monitors, sleep monitors, even baby monitors. You name it, it'll be connected to the internet.
You sound pretty excited about all this. Are you so sure it's such a great thing?
I think it's an amazing thing. Come on. Billions of smart devices collecting and analyzing reams and reams of data, autonomously sharing it all without any human intervention or decision-making involved.
I don't know. That sounds like a dystopia to me. I mean, you really want to build a world like that?
Well, you think about it. Think about America's crumbling infrastructure. Our bridges are terrible, right? You know that, right? Well, so imagine smart bridges that constantly monitor their own state and then automatically alert the transportation department when they need repair, and they can shut down the bridge, reroute traffic by signaling all the internet-enabled cars to go a different way while they're waiting to be worked on. That's really cool.
Yeah, all right, that is cool. Look, I'm no Luddite. I'm just saying, if every device I own, or even devices I don't own, I'm just interacting with, if all those devices are collecting and sharing data on me all the time, automatically, I don't know, man.
You sound a little worried. Worried about your privacy, I bet.
Yeah, privacy, sure, and security, too. I mean, this Internet of Things of yours sounds like a hacker's paradise.
Well, not if you encrypt everything.
Okay, sure, but look, anything that can be encrypted can be decrypted.
Well, yeah, only if you know the encryption key, and the way they do encryption these days, people assure me we live in a hack-proof world, or we could live in a hack-proof world.
Okay, if you say so. But look, I mean, even if you could encrypt all that data in a hack-proof way, Governments are going to want a backdoor into all this. Those governments love their backdoors.
You know, no doubt they do. But you know what? The thing about government, Josh, ultimately governments are answerable to us, the citizens. And if we don't accept backdoors, well, they can't have their backdoors, no matter what they want.
I feel like you're being a little overconfident in our powers, citizens, Ken. Plus, look, it's not just the American government. Governments all over the world are going to want backdoors.
Well, let them want them. We'll fight back. I mean, a part of the Internet of Things will have to be a worldwide campaign for consumer rights. Yeah, we can't just give our rights away.
Okay, let me get this straight. You're imagining spanning the globe with a network of things that collect, store, analyze, and share information on just about everything you and I do, just about everything anyone is doing.
Right.
And you think governments and bad guys aren't going to figure out ways to get their grubby little hands on all those data? Dream on.
Well, look, come on. I admit there's a challenge there, but you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, surely you want some of this data to be collected and shared. I wear a fitness tracking device everywhere I go. I want medical researchers to have access to the data I generated. I mean, at least if it's depersonalized and aggregated with other people's data, I think that's a good thing.
Maybe that's a good thing, but what about your insurance company? You want those guys to have access to that information?
Oh, gosh, Josh. Okay, I grant you, that's a little bit different. That's a different calculus.
Okay, so look, ask yourself this. Who's going to own and control all of the information? I don't think it's going to be you and me, the individual consumers. I think it's going to be the private corporations.
But Josh, I hate to tell you this. We've already crossed that Rubicon. A huge corporations already track just about every click you make on the current internet.
Right, and that's why a bunch of people have abandoned the internet for the dark web, you know, that troubling territory beyond the reach of the prying eyes. And I feel like if we push the internet beyond cyberspace and out into physical space, we're just going to drive more and more people underground.
Well, that's pretty hard to deny. I grant you that. But look, I just don't see much hope of completely stopping, as you seem to want, the growth of either the Internet of Things or of the dark web. But that day's coming, Josh.
You may be right. All I'm saying is let's slow down a little. Let's take a moment, step back, and think about where all this might be headed before we take the plunge.
Well, okay, that's a good idea. We agree. And to help us get started, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to find out why some people are so excited about the upside potential of the Internet of Things. She files this report.
Meet Jeremy, my housemate who loves to be woken up for interviews.
What are you talking about?
Jeremy has chronic and often debilitating, painful Lyme disease. So he has a lot of prescriptions.
How many pills are we talking about?
I don't know, hundreds a week.
When his symptoms were really bad, every week he had to sort these hundreds of pills into two organizers.
Well, I had to kind of create a whole station of all the different medicines and then kind of like an assembly line. And it was very difficult because my neck was messed up and using my arms and the dexterity required in order to place pills into little boxes for 30 minutes made things much more difficult.
What would end up happening? Like, would you do this every week?
No, I would end up not doing it.
Or you would ask me.
I would ask my housemate or my mom to come do it for me, but then that made me feel bad because it was such a hassle for them to do.
So your options were like continue to impose on other people, injure your neck more, or not take the pills and potentially make the problem worse in unanticipated ways in the future.
Yes.
Now, imagine an internet-enabled medicine organizer that could do all of this for my housemate. Keep inventory, sort and dispense medicine daily, even record symptoms and side effects as they change. At this point, it's just a fantasy. But so was a watch that counts the calories you burn on your run. An alarm clock that starts your coffee maker. You can voice activate a song to play from speakers in any room in your house.
Alexa, play my dance mix.
And you can heat up your thermostat using your phone as you drive home from work.
Changing set point to 72 degrees.
All of these innovations are part of the Internet of Things. It's like a charm that casts statues to life. Our things are going online. But they still have a lot of growing up to do. They're held back by the artificial intelligence technology inside them. The industry calls this machine learning.
Machine learning is a pretty mature technology.
This is Mark Jaffe, a technologist and CEO of a company called Allure Securities.
It's used today to help us finish our search strings when we're in our browser every day, and it's recommending what I might be looking for, or it's recommending on Spotify the next song I want to listen to, or it's helping me to understand that an equipment in my company needs some preventative maintenance.
But he says putting sensors and computers in objects is only helpful if the objects can make sense of the information they collect. For example, those traffic prediction signs you see on the freeway, you know, 49 minutes to the bridge, they use some simple machine learning. But soon they'll do more. Predict where road maintenance is needed before an emergency repair becomes necessary. And eventually, customize traffic lights in real time.
These sensors create enormous volumes of data, massive volumes of data that machine learning is really required to enable those insights, because the volume of data is just daunting and overwhelming volumes for human analysis.
IoT, as they say, is growing from smart homes to smart cities to help urban systems run better than mere humans can design them.
So I think there's lots of great advances that we'll get in our lives with IoT, but only with the application of some of the machine learning technology that's already been applied in other areas.
Of course, there is a flip side. The more our world depends on self-governing technology that knows us better than we know ourselves, the more we're at the mercy of those who control that technology. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks for that upbeat look at the Internet of Things, Liza. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're thinking about the Internet of Things.
We're joined now by Carl Hewitt. He's professor emeritus of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT and co-editor of Inconsistency Robustness Studies in Logic. Carl, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much.
So, Carl, I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about the Internet of Things, both its upside and its downside. But tell me, before we dig in, what first piqued your interest in this kind of topic?
Well, Ken, when I was a young professor at MIT, I got to know J.C.R. Licklider. And he was an amazing person because when he was BBN, he got to use a personal computer all by himself, but it cost $1 million. So we went to work for the Defense Department and got the funding for MIT, Stanford, SRI, and Carnegie that built the technology for the personal computer so everybody could have one.
Fantastic. And now here we are on the verge of an Internet of Things. And, you know, we were talking earlier about worries that we might have. I know you have some of your own, but let's start from the upside. Give us an example of something cool and beneficial that you're excited about that's going to come out of the Internet of Things.
Well, right now we have this huge problem with elderly people falling and breaking their hips. In the future, we're going to have prosthetics which dynamically adjust and will be able to prevent a large number of these falls by the elderly, just by dynamic monitoring what's going on and preventing them from falling.
So wait a minute. These are attached to their bodies, right?
They are indeed.
So the Internet of Things, we talked about the vast variety of things hooked up to the Internet. One of the things that are going to be hooked up to the Internet is like us.
Our bodies.
Right. Our bodies are going to be part of the Internet of Things.
That's right. Already we have insulin pumps and heart makers, and soon we're going to have hologlasses.
What is a hologlass?
A hologlass is going to be the replacement for our cell phone, only you'll wear it on your eyes. Everything you can currently do with your cell phone, you'll be able to do more easily with your eyes.
So
with
like
the advantage,
dial a number, like with just by looking? Well, how will I dial a number?
Well, actually, a lot of this, the exact technology by which this is going to happen is one of the most closely guarded secrets in the valley, right? Because whoever gets that interface right will win.
Yeah, but we won't tell anybody.
Except for all the millions of people listening to the radio.
But everything you currently do with your cell phone, you will be able to do with greater functionality with these hologlasses. Only I won't have to be look down at my phone anymore. I'll be able to look at you while I'm doing it.
So that sounds like a sort of a convenience, a saving of time and energy and so on. But the prosthetics, that sounds like an actual life-saving device.
But in industry, these hologlasses will be necessary for your work. You will not be able to perform your factory work. You will not be able to drive your truck without your hologlasses.
So both of these things, they extend my body to the Internet. I mean, I wear them, and there's an interface between. I've heard about neuroprosthetics. Do you know about it? Well, with implants in your brain.
Yeah. That is something that will happen, but that's more like the completely computer-driven car 30 years away. The hologlasses are within 10 years.
Well, 30 years. I mean, some young person. Tell me about it. What kind of brain implant, really briefly?
Really briefly, currently what you can do with brain implants is you can do things like, you know, in a very limited way, play a computer game, right? Or you can bring two robots together and lift a box. But they are way, way far away. You can't do anything significant with brain implants.
Okay, but the day is coming, and you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the Internet of Things with computer scientist Carl Hewitt.
In our next segment, we're going to talk about privacy and security in the age of the Internet of Things. Will the Internet of Things create a hacker's paradise? And what does privacy mean when every device you own or operate is collecting data on your every movement?
privacy, security, and the Internet of Things. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. What happens to privacy when everything in your house is watching you? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking about the Internet of Things. Our guest is Carl Hewitt, Professor Emeritus of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT.
So, in the opening, Carl, Josh worried a lot about security and privacy. A lot of people are worried about these things. Let's take security first. How do we stop this Internet of Things from becoming just a hacker's paradise? How are we going to do that?
Actually, I'm not so much worried about the hackers by comparison to the governments, because we can protect our devices. And if we can protect the devices, encryption means the communications between the devices are meaningless. So the question boils down to protecting our devices.
Wait a minute. Okay, slow down. So we've got the devices. Mm-hmm. We've got the transmission of the data between devices. The devices. We got storage of the data on the cloud, right, in data centers. I mean, if you sound so sanguine.
But Ken, if you use Signal, there's nothing stored in the cloud. There's nothing stored in the data centers. Your device and my device have their own public key, private key pair, and the communication is completely safe unless they break into your device.
So, okay, you think the focus should be on the devices. Does that mean in the Internet of Things there won't be this massive collection and pooling of data?
In the data centers, there will be completely massive pooling and collection, which will be available, hopefully under a subpoena, to any government. In the data centers.
So that's already pretty terrible.
Now, the question is, can we do a grand bargain and protect our devices so we can keep our most sensitive information on our devices protected against self-incrimination in the United States by the Fifth Amendment?
Josh, are you satisfied with it? All that? I mean, you were the one worried about this. Are you satisfied?
I remain worried. So, I mean, even leaving aside the data that's at the data centers, we should come back to that. But think about our devices. I mean, you know, the FDA recently recalled 500,000 pacemakers because they were deemed to be susceptible to hacking. Imagine if somebody hacked your pacemaker. If a hacker figured out how to hack his way into a hearing aid and put voices into somebody's head. Like, I feel like, yeah, maybe we could encrypt these devices, but look at what happened with Equifax. I mean, are people actually going to encrypt them in the real world such that they won't be hackable? Because if they are, terrible things could ensue.
Well, Equifax was in the data center.
That's a good
talking about. We're talking about the devices. The devices are relatively simple, and computer scientists now have the technology using tagged memory architecture and encryption on the device so that we will be able to protect the devices, except that Senator Burrs and Feinstein know that we're going to be able to protect their devices. So they proposed legislation that the companies will have to provide backdoors.
So you're not worried about hackers. You are worried about backdoors. The reason you're not worried about hackers is because you're focused on the devices, right? But, of course, we live in a world now. I mean, Josh has already mentioned some famous hacks. There was the Yahoo hack. We just had an election that was in some ways hacked. Well, I mean, if what you say is true, why is there so much hacking going and successful and extensive hacking going on now?
And the Mirai attack used the internet.
Yeah, so yes. where does all that come from?
The data centers are incredibly complicated, and we computer scientists are going to have a very hard time securing those data centers. But our devices are relatively simple, and those things we can secure, except if the government has a mandatory backdoor. Think about it for your Holo glasses. They will be able to see and hear everything you do see and hear if they have a back door.
Let me ask you another question that Josh raised in the opening. Who owns the information around the world in different regimes? I take it that I own the information on my cell phone, right?
That is correct. With HealthKit, you can store it on your phone and never put it in an Apple data center.
Right. But Apple, when I agree to all that stuff that they tell me to agree to that I never read, What rights do they have with respect to this information? Because they're sharing all kinds of
information. If you put it in their data centers, they have rights to it, and that's why you tick it off. But if you just keep it using HealthKit on your device, then, as in the case of San Bernardino, they will try to protect you, and they will succeed until Burr Feinstein passes.
See, here's the thing I don't get. Just the logic of what you're saying. I don't get what's in it for the producer of these devices. Because it's one thing for all this device to generate lots of information and not share it, but what is the producer of this device after? Not just you're buying and using this device, but the producer of this device, the capitalist, is after this information.
That's right.
And after analyzing this information and using this information to make more products and to sell you more things and to connect this to that and that. So the logic, the capitalist logic of what you're saying doesn't make any sense
to me. Absolutely right, Ken. And the way they make the money is on the device. It's got all your information. Google only has a piece. Yahoo, they has it all. And they can serve advertising. They can connect you with a merchant on the device and never put it in the data center and do a better job and make money the old-fashioned way by connecting you with the merchant.
Okay. So I'm not totally convinced yet that my phone isn't going to be hackable, but let's say it is. What about
or your heart monitor or your house?
Not hackable. Hearing aid, all these things that yeah. have been hacked before, yeah. right? But let's say we can arrive at that age. What about all the other elements of the Internet of Things that don't belong to me?
It's just your personal things. The TV in your bedroom that's currently connected to a data center in China, your home router, your refrigerator, your personal devices must be protected by the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination. Like you're thinking.
This is in the future. You're talking about in the future. No
court has decided. Burr Feinstein hasn't passed yet.
Yeah, yeah. But no court has weighed in on this. Whether your personal devices count as an extension of yourself. But I want to step back. I want to step back.
The Supreme Court is considering it.
I want to step back for a second. Because here's what it seems to me that's happening. The built environment, right? The built physical social environment, right? The cyberspace is being merged with the built social physical environment. And not only is cyberspace being merged with that, the built physical social environment is becoming a, quote, smart environment, mm-hmm. which is data collecting and analyzing. And we are kind of interlopers or something. I'm not quite sure how to think of us in relationship to this new built environment.
Data generators.
Mm-hmm. That we look like data generators for the people who build and control this built environment. Am I being too alarmist?
No, I think you're being exactly right in the sense that your personal devices are basically part of your person. They're an integral part of you. You store things there. You interact with them on a personal basis. So yourself just got bigger, slightly bigger. It's now your personal Internet of Things.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the Internet of Things. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And Robert from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Robert.
Yeah, I'd like to point out two good books, recent books on this. One by Foer, called World Without Mind. The second one is Yuval Harari, Homo Deus.
Okay.
And Harari in particular feels that we're giving up our individuality to a new religion based on data. And this new god, Homo Deus, is going to have a profound effect. Let me just read one sentence from the end of his book. Allow Google and Facebook to read all your emails, record all your clicks and likes, do all that. Then the great algorithms of the Internet of all things will tell you whom to marry, which career to pursue, and whether to start a war.
Well, thanks for that intervention there, Robert. Josh, I think you want to react to this.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my worries, too. I want to see what Carl thinks about this as well. But, you know, obviously we have worries about privacy. But going along with that, you might think there's also worries about autonomy and authenticity, right? Because, yeah, if the data are telling you what to do, where's your autonomy? You know, one of the things that could happen is that you set or it detects a certain set of preferences that you have, right? Your smart fridge knows the kind of wine you like. So it encourages you to buy the same wine again. And you might get locked into a certain kind of pattern of behavior and preferences that maybe aren't really you anymore, wouldn't be you anymore. So are there sort of more subtle downstream consequences of this in terms of the way in which we think about ourselves? Getting locked into, as the caller was saying, Robert was saying, you know, you're going to do things based on what the data tell you rather than what you actually currently believe?
The question is, who are your personal devices working for you? Are they traitorous devices that are acting against you? Or are the things that you own that are working for you? If they're your personal devices that are working for you and with you, then you become a greater person. It's like you got a calculator. That didn't mean the end of people being able to do arithmetic. It just meant...
Yeah, but I think an exhaustive dichotomy there, an exhaustive disjunction, because here's how I think a good capitalist works. This may sound bad, but I think it's actually good. I mean, where did the iPhone come from? It did not come from a consumer saying, well, I want an iPhone. It came from Steve Jobs and his cohort saying, I want you to inhabit that consumer's world more deeply than that consumer. I want you to design something such that when it's in that consumer's hand, the consumer says, wow, I want an iPhone. And then I want you to make them want more iPhones and more iPhones, right? And this kind of technology has the power to take demand-creating capitalism to the nth level. Right, because I am going to totally inhabit your world. I'm going to totally study your habits. I'm going to be able to use the imagination of my really cool designers to say, make them want this, right? And I think that can be a good thing because, you know, human desires aren't always articulated and I help them articulate them, but I can also impose things. So I think...
To be successful, they're going to need consumers to buy billions of hologlasses. That's the next big thing for the Valley, right? That will produce the revenue for Apple and these other device makers.
But I just think Josh's worry, married to the logic of capitalism, is an interesting stew. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with me? Disagree?
I agree. I mean, I think I absolutely think that there's a worry coming from the side of marketing, right? That
yes.
To some extent, people are going to be doing things for the benefit of the consumer, but obviously, to some extent, it's going to be for their own benefit. And those two preferences may not always align.
Right. But I mean, look, I don't want to deny that there's some like smart cities, what they call smart cities and smart roads and all that and smart cars. Those are good things that will help us solve real problems. But I don't think they're merely good things that will merely help us solve real problems. They'll give us a whole new relationship to the world. And I'm not quite sure how we manage that relationship to the world. I mean, you're a computer scientist. You're more focused on the technology and preventing. But I mean, as a computer scientist, put on your pure computer scientist hat. Do you ever think as a computer scientist about, oh, we're going too fast with this technology? Or is that just like left to politics and philosophers? I mean, as you as a computer scientist, do you ever feel like we ought to slow down with this?
No, we shouldn't slow down, but we have to guide it. We have to guide it away from ways that we have to guide it away so that we don't have an internet of traitorous devices. But at the same time, as a computer scientist, we know we have to make a case for a business model for what we do. There's a definite need to connect consumers with merchants. Right now, we do it through the data centers. But in the future, we can do it through our devices and make the business model that way.
We've got another caller in the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael. What's your comment or question?
Yes. We're aware that large data centers and other organizations that may have populations of servers and so forth and so on are acutely aware that there are capabilities to detect in those environments vulnerabilities such as unpatched software and middleware and operating systems and so forth and so on. But that they are only as good as human intervention in the effort to correct those vulnerabilities. And so my question is, are there not capabilities for automated detection of a situation where an organization or a device be transmitting data to another organization, let's say Equifax, and then detecting that, this organization is not patch current, or this organization has vulnerabilities, or they do not have the encryption that I require as part of my agreement to send them data or receive data from them, and then shut down that service until the vulnerabilities are addressed?
Good question, Michael. Thanks for the call. What do you think, Carl?
This is a very good question, and it's one of our very most enormous problems. Our data centers are so complicated that we have no way to audit them. We can't tell that an intelligence agency is not stealing enormous amounts of data out of our data centers indetectably. And that's actually happened to Yahoo and Google Okay, and so
you mean to be sanguine about this?
If it goes into the data centers, the government can get it. Your only protection is what is on your devices.
So I once read something or heard something about the theory of encryption and all that, and how we're entering an age in which encryption is basically essentially unbreakable and all this stuff, right? But a theory is one thing. The practice is another. Theory and practice in real life, where, because this is related to Michael's question, in real life where you have human beings making decisions, corporations looking at the bottom line, real cost curves that may, you know, say, oh, gee, if we invest that much in making these things secure, the price is going to be so high. So, I mean, how do you make theory and practice, like, dovetail?
We trust our nuclear command and control system to encryption. We generate the public key, private key pair in a Faraday cage. The private key never leaves the Faraday cage. Software never sees it, cannot be stolen.
Right. This is the kind of talk I heard about how foolproof encryption is these days.
It's not foolproof, but we trust our nuclear command and control system to it, so we have high confidence.
Yes, but we're willing to invest whatever it takes there. But I'm talking about private industry that has a real cost-benefit curve.
Right. The data centers are vulnerable, but our devices, using the same trick of putting the generating a public key, private key pair in your device in a Faraday cage, can protect them too.
So as long as we keep it all on the devices... Mm-hmm. Right. As long as we don't share it with the data center. Are you happy, Josh?
Sorry. not yet. So here's a thought. I'm wearing my, what did you call them, hologlasses?
Hologlasses, yeah.
I keep my information. But look, you're looking at me with your hologlasses. Mm-hmm. So a lot of data about me is actually being transmitted to the data center through
only
your
if I transmit it to the data center. I'm not transmitting the data center either. We're shaking hands on it right here.
Okay, you've got a deal.
Yes, but I just don't believe this is going to happen. I think you're dreaming, Carl. I really do. I think there's too much structure that the people who create these things want this data transmitted to the data center, and they're going to find a way to get it transmitted to the data center because it's much more useful to them if it is. But we'll take up some more of this after a short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the Internet of Things with computer scientist Carl Hewitt.
In our final segment, we're going to ask what, if anything, we can do as consumers to protect ourselves from those prying eyes of government, corporations, and the internet equivalent of the peeping Tom.
Suppressing surveillance when Philosophy Talk continues. Your romantic partner may hear your nighttime secrets, but soon your toaster and washing machine will be listening too. I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Carl Hewitt from MIT, and we're thinking about the Internet of Things.
And we've got a caller who wants to join this conversation, Charles in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charles.
Thank you. My question is about storing all of our personal data on our personal devices. What happens when our devices are lost or stolen? Won't we lose all our personal data?
What about that?
That's an excellent question. I actually have an article on this in the Social Science Research Network that you can get online for free. And the answer is that you can back the information on your devices up in the cloud, provided it's encrypted with your public key, so you're the only one who can decrypt it. So your devices will be continuously backing this stuff up in the cloud in a way that only you can get it back.
So let me ask you a question. Thanks for the call, Charles. I want to build on Charles' thing, though, because I know that guy, that terrorist in San Bernardino, right, he had an iPhone, and the Apple wouldn't help the government, but the government hacked his iPhone. Right.
They bought a hack.
They what do you mean? There was an
off the shelf? Yeah. There are people out there that sell hacks.
Okay. So I take it. So that wasn't hack proof, the iPhone that he had. Was that because it was an old iPhone or something like that?
It was an old iPhone. The new iPhones are better, and they're getting better and better.
They're getting better and better.
And they're getting so good that that's why Senator Burr and Feinstein are demanding this new legislation. So that they can force the installation of backdoors in all IoT.
Right, right. What I'm wondering about is legacy technology, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I have friends, older friends, who have really old iPhones, whom I would think those aren't very secure at all compared to the iPhone 10 or whatever just came out, mm-hmm. right? So what do we do about that fact? And is the Internet of Things going to have to be such that you're constantly replacing your devices? And I mean, how's that going to work?
People really need to be really secure, like lawyers and reporters, already use the most secure phone that they have at any given time. And so it really depends on how much you value the information that you have and what the threat is against you. But the defenses are going to become very, very good. And without the absent the Burr-Feinstein legislation, that's going to become almost impossible to break in.
Okay, so we should just go gung-ho to the Internet of Things, it sounds like. There's no downside to this thing. Is that what you're telling me?
If they have the Burr-Feinstein legislation and the back doors in your HoloGlasses, it will be Big Brother sees and hears everything everybody sees, hears, and says. So it's either a huge upside or a huge downside.
So we should only go forward with this if we can trust government. You don't seem very worried about corporations. If we can, because it seems as though you think the business interest of the corporation kind of aligns with the consumer. Am I right about that?
No, it doesn't. But if you have your personal information on your own devices, then you're on a fair footing with the corporation. If you have the information in their data centers, they've won.
So what's going to make it to be the case that the information, because again, it seems to me the information much more useful to the corporation. And their incentives are to get that in their data center, to get it pulled data. I mean, these things are collecting all this mm-hmm. data. I mean, they're just doing it.
But the government is the corporation is also incredibly vulnerable if they have your sensitive information in the data centers, because then the government wants it from them, and then they want to go and implant their spies in the government data centers, right? So the corporations also don't want to have your private information.
I think
they just want to have the aggregate.
I think we should call a halt to this and think this through much more. I don't know what you think, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, the way I'm thinking about it, maybe you could do that for your phone and things like that. But what about smart meters? I mean, you know, we had smart meters installed. We had no choice in the matter. Those meters send data out to the data centers whether we want it or not. So maybe we could exert some control if we're lucky and,
right.
and powerful over our cell phones, but I don't know if we can exert it over everything in the internet.
Yeah, because you're excessively focused, it seems, on personal devices, right? But the Internet of Things is not going to just be about personal devices. It's going to be about the entire built environment, right?
That's true, and hopefully there'll be enough information available out there in the data centers to do law enforcement, because we are in favor of law enforcement. The question is, can we have a grand bargain so that some of our information on our personal devices, like our heart monitors, et cetera, which is protected by the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination, and that they can't get?
Right. We've got another caller in the line, George from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, George. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. You know, this question comes up, should the Internet of Things be protective of humans? But then doesn't this also invoke Isaac Asimov's rules for robots? In what way doesn't the three rules for robots apply to the universe of things?
Remind me of those three rules. I read that a long time ago, but remind me of those three
rules.
Well,
there is a rule that says that no robot shall do anything which brings harm to a human. There are two other rules that I can't summon at the moment, and we wanted to make this call, so we're counting on you to have the other rules handy.
Thanks, George. Well, I mean, the thrust of the question, I take it, is how do we make sure that these things serve us rather than us serving it? Because, again, the built environment, by extending cyberspace and elements of artificial intelligence into the built environment, we're making an environment that senses us, that senses everything we do, that analyzes us, that decides, makes decisions on the basis of its analysis, so it acts on us and perhaps for our benefit, but not necessarily. So how do we make sure that this new, made smart, pervasive built environment that senses and monitors us and analyzes us, that it actually serves us? How do we do that?
I think that we have to preserve our personal devices as our allies. They're working for us, and then we do not have the Internet of traitorous things.
Okay, right.
And then if they're working for us, then we can buy products that work for us. It becomes a marketplace. If it works better for us, we'll buy that one as opposed to the one that doesn't work as well for us.
So you think that if we take care of the personal devices serve us rather than the manufacturers of those personal devices, then the other devices, because it's not just going to be personal devices, right? A traffic monitoring system, a bridge monitoring system, an airplane. I was listening to a thing about airplane, self-monitoring airplane engines, right, that can keep track of the various stresses and all that. And right, those devices, they're not designed to serve me. They're designed... So you think that if we can take care of the personal devices, we don't really have to worry about these other devices that are part of the built world?
Well, we'd like to still have the courts involved in the subpoenas. We don't want the FBI or other law enforcement rummaging through everything willy-nilly. But we do have to give enough information that's available by subpoena to do law enforcement.
Right. It just still worries me that a good proportion of the Internet of Things is going to be devices that are collecting data on us, whether we like it or not. They're not personal. These are not personal devices over which we're going to have control.
Right. See, the thing is, you kind of become, your life becomes a collection of data points, right? I mean, you can say that now. But you can say it, because every time you drive down the road, some traffic cop could be out there counting the cars, right? Mm-hmm. But the data...
With a subpoena.
Right, definitely. But the data generation becomes ubiquitous, and your movements in the physical world, because the built environment is a monitoring, analyzing, sensing environment... You become
yeah, and I'm a little worried. Maybe this is a more rarefied worry, but I'm a little worried about the shrinking of the private sphere.
Because, exactly
right. I mean, don't we need spaces just to become ourselves? Don't we need spaces where nobody's looking? Right?
See, what I worry is that the notion of privacy, as we understood it, is an 18th century notion. It doesn't really fit in the 21st century because where can I go, and prying eyes, as it were, can't follow me. Right. Well, I can go into my house. But wait a minute. My whole house is wired. I can go into my backyard.
But those are your personal internet.
It's still wired. It's still wired. It's still monitoring and sensing me. I can't, unless I could just turn it off, right? But I'd have to, disconnect.
Right. I mean, my smart meter knows if my lights are on.
Right. It's disconnecting from the electrical grid. Like, it's the equivalent. I have to disconnect.
If it's working for you,
then it's no big deal.
If it's not a traitor...
I'm going to try and get one last caller in here. If you promise to be brief, Al from Berkeley, be brief, and you'll be the last caller.
I'll be very brief. I'm concerned about the harmful effects, the negative effects on our own health, our own body, and our own natural algorithms that this technology is overlooking. There have been wonderful books written about this. I suggest anything written by Sherry Turkle of MIT, who's studied this for almost half a century now. And very little thought is given to it, in the same way that Adolf Diesel, who invented the internal combustion engine, would be appalled to know that his invention was used up by petrochemical energies rather than vegetable and natural fruits and vegetable energy, as he had purported.
Right. Thanks a lot for the call, Al. Brief look, he's worried about the radiation effects and stuff like that.
The Internet of Things is going to be tremendous for our health. Already we have insulin pumps, we have heart pacemakers, right? We're going to have pill counters, as we said. It's going to be fantastic for us, provided that they're working for us and not somebody else.
So there, that's your mantra. We've got to make sure that these devices work for us. So, last question, last thought. How do we guarantee what structures in our economy and our politics and our social life and our economy guarantees that these devices work for us?
That there be no mandatory backdoors, because otherwise the market will solve it for us, because we'll buy devices that are working for ourselves. If they're mandatory backdoors, then we're toast.
So stopping the backdoors, that's the key. Okay. On that note, Carl, I'm going to thank you for joining us. I was going to say it's been a thrilling conversation, but I'm still a little troubled. But thank you anyway.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Carl Hewitt. He's a professor emeritus of electrical engineering and computer science from MIT and co-editor of Inconsistency Robustness, Studies in Logic. So, Josh, are you worried stilled?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, look, I'm I'm excited and concerned. I have a mix of feelings, right? Because look, definitely sign me up for an exoskeleton in 30 years. I mean, I think there are going to be some great benefits on the horizon. Convenience, health benefits, I'm really persuaded by Carl about that. Environmental benefits, I think there's going to be a lot of great things on the horizon, but at the same time, I think there's going to be huge costs in privacy, autonomy, authenticity. I'm not convinced at all that it's going to be hack-proof.
Yeah, and I think Carl's a computer scientist, and, you know, that's his, he's a gung-ho computer scientist. But I think philosophers, social scientists, people like us, have to think more about what does it actually mean to be a human and live a human life in a built environment that is constantly monitoring you, constantly analyzing you, filled with distributed intelligence, making decisions that might have been left to human beings and responsible governments. I just think that's a huge sea change, and we need to think about it.
I agree. And look, for now, I'm hanging on to my dumb fridge.
Well, there you go. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog. And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, I mean, we got to a lot, but there are probably a lot more out there. We'd love to hear from you. Send your questions to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might just feature it on the blog.
You can also become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org. Now here's a guy talking faster than the smartest device out there. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when you read Wired or an online magazine or listen to NPR, there would sooner or later be this, oh my gosh, gee whiz, what do they think of next story about tech? Imagine a television no larger than a postage stamp. Wired is still around, but NPR is slowly succumbing to podcasts. Podcasts, wow. Imagine a world where you can listen to radio programs. Not in the radio, of course. Who does that? And the magazines have vanished into the ether, replaced by internet clickbait factories. This is from one called Pop Sugar. Quote, imagine getting a tattoo that can measure your heart rate, or sleeping in a bed that will automatically elevate your head to stop any snoring. Maybe you'd rather put your makeup on with a mirror that analyzes your skin, unquote. When I was a kid, I went with my dad to a Home of Tomorrow exhibit at the New York World's Fair. It was a ranch-style home, only completely underground, like a high-class fallout shelter. It had a patio overlooking a backyard that was a desert landscape, and you could adjust the lighting from dawn to high noon to dusk to night, complete with a tape of crickets. Of course, it's just a diorama of a desert. If you walked out into nature, you'd bonk your head on concrete. That was another place, another time, a hopeful prototype meant to show that even if it came to a nuclear showdown with Russia, life would go on with fake crickets and the great books, cans of beans, and 16mm copies of Hollywood movies to keep us occupied until the all-clear sounds a couple hundred years down the road. Now, we seem to be leaping into the dystopian world of tomorrow again, only this time for the hell of it. Not out of self-preservation, the Internet of Things, hair with state-of-the-art subatomic microchips that can cut itself. Imagine a world where your car stops if you're too drunk to drive. Imagine a blender that knows you hate papayas. Now, a coffee maker that drinks the coffee for you. Gluten removed at a whispered command. Your milk is going bad, and your refrigerator knows it. It's just one robot talking to another, but before you know it, you're knee-deep in healthy butter substitutes. Smart cement built bridges to alert you when it's iced over, warming automatically to melt snow, to warn of puddles. Stoplights that respond to traffic flow. But wait, are we even going to be driving in the future? If it's all robots, why do we need traffic lights? Why do we need to go home? Just stay in the car. Have the robot make us a sandwich on the 3D printer. Why drive anywhere? Every place looks exactly the same. Robots, robots, robots. If you want an exotic environment, just put on the holo glasses. Don't even need to program them. The algorithms compute what you want to see based on your data usage history. We're supposed to be worried about back doors in the Internet of Things. The government will sneak in there and know all our secrets. Well, what secrets? We told them all to Google and Facebook in 2005. Now, here's the funny thing. The Internet of Things is supposed to free us from boring tasks so we can write novels and poetry, paint, dance, act in plays, catch up on movies. We're not going to do any of those things. We can barely read a tweet, much less a novel, much less write one. The only movies we will watch in the future will be the ones embedded in our eyelids. Now here, write this down while you still can. Tattoo it on the back of your hand. The smartphone is not your friend. The oven does not know you. Your car will never love you. That's just the algorithms talking. It's Chinatown, Jake. Just walk away. Oh, and as you're walking, be sure to track your activity on your Fitbit. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Owlet. Rest assured. Get your Owlet Smart Sock today.